freedom and democracy and the overall goodness that shined over the world like God's city on the hill. And we will eat turkey and cauliflower and pumpkin pie forever and ever. Amen. It was such a nice, uplifting story, and I was shocked to learn years later that most of it was pretty much a lie. It had just been a little too sweet. But stories are powerful, especially when they become myths. That story that so many of us learned year after year in grade school is a myth. A myth is a guiding story that tells people who they are. This myth tells Americans we are hard-working people, and we've been willing to sacrifice for freedom and democracy. It tells us we are good, innocent people with a larger purpose. It tells us Native peoples blessed our presence on this land. The Thanksgiving myth is based on two paragraphs in two letters from two Pilgrim men. Paragraphs largely ignored until just before the Civil War, rediscovered by the editor of Godey's Lady Book, the 19th century's Ladies' Home Journal. She went on a crusade to make this meal a national holiday and invented the idea of the turkey dinner. Venison and fish seemed to be actually what was ate at this meal. She wrote, "President Lincoln, who would happen to be desperately seeking a story to unite the people of the United States, a story to get families, who were often fractured over the issues of the Civil War, sitting around tables together, a story to get everyone to remember we were one people fighting for freedom." Thanksgiving became a national holiday in 1863. This myth, enacted in ritual meal, has lasted 150 years. The ritual spread across the United States during the time the military was killing Native people for their land across the West. It was a balm, a way to remind people of American goodness instead of the horrifying truth. It was a story of a gentle, sweet passing of the land from the people who had lived here for 12,000 years to those who would use it to bless the world with democracy and freedom, instead of the actual story of genocide and land theft. The Thanksgiving story, as I learned it, created the impression that that fateful meeting of the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag was the first meeting of English and Indigenous people. Actually, the English had been trading for furs and raiding the coast for slaves for nearly a century. Just months before the Pilgrims landed, Tisquantum, who some of us know as Squanto, a Wampanoag man had managed to return to Plymouth 5 years after he was kidnapped to be sold into slavery. When the Pilgrims arrived, he greeted them with perfect English. 3 to 5 years before the Pilgrims arrived, a European disease, which one is still debated, washed through the Wampanoag, killing between 75% and 90% of the population. Can you imagine? The Wampanoag were not a picturesque and friendly people welcoming strangers. They were a traumatized and grieving people, concerned about war with the neighboring Narragansetts, who saw a chance to steal their land. The Wampanoag's relationship with the Pilgrims was a carefully considered strategy to use English weapons to help protect them from their rivals. 53 survivors of the Mayflower celebrated their plentiful harvest at that first Thanksgiving dinner. In joy, they shot off their guns. According to Wampanoag lore, 90 of their warriors rushed down to check out the situation. Then they hung out for 3 days to make sure it really was a celebration and not an uprising. They killed some deer. That's true, and everyone shared food. When information about the other side is added to the narrative, the myth falls away. The story doesn't hold up the ideals of American superiority, innocence, and manifest destiny anymore. Around the beginning of the 21st century, there was a belief in scientific history. Historians, this story went, would uncover facts and put them in order, and that would be the truth, with a capital T. Some people still believe this is what history, as an academic discipline, is. The truth about what happened. While history is discovering information about the past, historians must put what they discover into a narrative that makes sense. A list of facts makes no sense. Historians are always part of their culture, creating narratives that work within the larger cultural context. Historians of different ages and cultural moments tell different stories about the past. Every narrative that humans create leaves out some information and emphasizes others. No narrative or explanation can hold everything. What is actually very complex and layered, everything is very complex and layered. Historians bring forth the information that tells the stories that the people of their time and place can and want to believe. For example, in Edward Winslow's letter about the 1621 Harvest Festival, he writes, "We exercised our arms. Many Indians came among us." Which historians for many years interpreted to mean, since they were forwarding the story of the friendly relationships between the Indians and the colonizers, that the Pilgrims invited the Indians to the celebration. It wasn't until the last decades, when oral traditions and the voice of non-white people became sources of history, did the idea come forward that maybe the Wampanoag warriors showed up and hung out for 3 days because they were worried about the guns going off and what that meant. Since many of us are now inclined to be interested in and listen to non-white voices, we can hear and believe this expanded story of the feast. Diverse experiences of the past became accepted during the 1960s, when people other than straight cis white men became accepted as full members of our society, women, Black people, Asians, Native Americans, Latinx, LGBTQ+, and others. It became possible with these changes in the structure of a society for these people's historical experience to become part of our country's overarching narrative. Historian William McNeil calls the work of the historians mythohistory, and believes that over time, mythohistories can become larger, holding more experience and complexity, but that historians always write mythohistory. History is always told to uphold who we understand ourselves to be and who we can become. With the inclusion of more voices, the United States' overarching story as a hard-working, good people forwarding the ideals of democracy and freedom was bound to break apart. In August of 2019, the New York Times published the 1619 Project. This project claimed not the Thanksgiving meal in the fall of 1621 as the foundational story of the beginning of the United States, but the selling of 20 black slaves into Virginia about 2 years earlier in the August of 1619. The truth of the United States, this series of articles claims, is not the sweet innocent of pilgrims fighting for religious freedom and the kind of support of people who live here. The truth of the United States is that it is built its economic power by enslaving people and mostly has pretended this isn't true. Textiers for years told the story of slavery only as a way to talk about the Civil War, underplaying how brutal and violent and how long-lasting it truly was, and implying that it wasn't that bad if the enslavers were kind. Slavery was seen as an exception to the story of American goodness, innocence, and the land of the free. Even the Civil War was taught to be about, was being about states' rights, even though the only right in question was the right to own people. While modern textbooks do generally discuss the brutality of slavery and accurately tell the cause of the Civil War, the topic is rarely covered in the depth that it might warrant. Children and youth learn the current mythohistory of our culture in classrooms, and for most, it is only the history they will ever learn, except perhaps in Hollywood epics, which also tell the current mytho-history. This explains the current battle over what is called critical race theory, but it is actually simply a battle over how race will be taught in schools. After the 16-9 Project was published and people exploded in outrage over George Floyd's murder less than a year later, many schools and teachers wanted a deeper exploration of racism and in the foundations in slavery and its foundations in slavery. At the same time, others felt this emphasis took away from the understanding of the U.S. as a good country that stands for freedom and democracy, where everyone has the opportunity, a country with only the barest blemishes of crime. Slavery was a bad moment, they argue, for sure, but we got past that long ago. These same critics don't want any of the history that points to the truth of systemic racism taught in history books. How the majority of black and brown people, as agricultural and domestic workers, were left out of the original Social Security Act. Or how most black soldiers couldn't use the GI Bill after World War II, since segregation limited how many college seats there were for black people. The practice of redlining is left out of high school textbooks in Texas. Those who fight racial education don't want any mention of how whites have been privileged educationally, socially, and economically. If you believe that the United States is a good, free country with endless opportunity for hard workers, you need to leave out the information that contradicts the evidence about our past. In a country as divided as ours, there is little question about why we are debating the history we teach our children. The history we believe is true affects who we believe we are. It affects what we will do going forward. If you believe the foundational story of our country was the sale of the first black slaves, you will respond differently to this moment than if you believe the foundation of our country is a story of religious freedom and supportive disappearing Native Americans, and believe slavery was a small mistake in a country with a great record of opportunity for all. What does this mean to us as Unitarian Universalists? Having the myths of American goodness and innocence crumble is uncomfortable. I couldn't even admit I didn't like cauliflower after I imbued it with such significance all those years ago. I loathed learning that so many of my revolutionary heroes were primarily out for their own economic self-interest. All men were created equal meant to Thomas Jefferson, only all white landholding men were created equal. Women, poor whites, black and brown people were not. However, Americans of every gender and race have read those words as people were created equal and have been inspired by them. The majority of Americans are trying to live the story that all people are created equal. However, there is no way to live this story without understanding the ways people have not been and are not equal. The way laws, violence, social norms, economic practices, stories, lies, myths have kept people unable to live fully and well. Clear examples from the past week are the reminder of how Kyle Rittenhouse was released after he killed two men, the rulings of the judge in the case, and the acquittal compared with the treatment of two black men wrongly convicted after evidence was hidden and imprisoned for over 50 years for Malcolm X's murder. Stories about barriers of violence, economic devastation, unfair laws, unequal treatment are not uplifting or inspiring. They aren't the sort of stories that hold a country together, like the story of a friendly shared meal across cultures on the Massachusetts shore. These are painful stories that cause denial and conflict. We see this. Teaching the material in the 1619 Project and Critical Race series is now banned in 13 states, including in some states at the university level. How to tell the story of who the United States is tearing school boards and communities apart. As Unitarian Universalists, we believe every person has worth and dignity. Our commitment is to tell stories and show how every person does have worth and dignity. We have a commitment to the responsible search for truth and meaning. History can never be truth with a capital T, since narratives must be crafted that include some things and leave out others. But our histories can expand larger and wider and be more inclusive and loving, which is profoundly responsible. Our calling at this time is to walk bravely into all that contested history and narratives and myths, ready to be challenged ourselves and to be uncomfortable and to set aside old myths. We can use what has been uncovered from the past to see clearly our present. Out of this chaos of competing stories, we can do the uncomfortable work of reaching out across the chasm to different lived experiences and histories. We can spin a web of inclusion and love. New stories will be told of the past, ones we have never heard, and of this present moment. By our actions now and the way we tell stories can create new tales, not of American goodness, but humble stories that show us as a loving and kind people who are very capable of breaking the strands that bind us together, but who also are capable of repairing them. Stories that show how communities can stand up to power and win. Stories that hold our true humanity before us and show us the skills we need to be a kind, inclusive culture. We can begin now, this year, on Thanksgiving Day, as we eat whatever we eat, whoever we will eat it with, by remembering that the day can simply be one of gratitude, as it was for the pilgrims. They were alive after much hardship. Whatever the rest of the story was, they had much to be grateful for themselves. So let us be grateful for all the blessings of our lives, life, food, health, and people. Let us feel how gratitude is a fundamental reminder of our deep interconnectedness. Once we know that truth with our whole beings, we can build a land.
Cities raising up dead. devastations from old, restoring ruins of generations. Oh, we'll build a land of people so bold. Come build a land where sisters and brothers, anointed by God, may then create peace, where justice shall roll down like waters, and peace like an ever-flowing stream. Come build a land where the mantles of praises resound from spirits once faint and once weak, where like oaks of righteousness stand her people. Oh, come build the land, my people we seek. Come build a land where sisters and brothers, anointed by God, may then create peace, where justice shall roll down like waters, and peace like an ever-flowing stream.
Our benediction is from the Reverend Peter Rabel. We build on foundations we did not lay. We warm ourselves by fires we did not light. We sit in the shade of trees we did not plant. We drink from wells we did not dig. We profit from persons we did not know. We are ever bound in community. May it always be so. And this is as it should be. Together we are more than any one person could be. Together we can build across generations. Together we can renew our hope and faith in the life that is yet to unfold. Together we can heed the call to a ministry of care and justice. We are ever bound in community. May it be so. I extinguish this flame, but not the vision and compassion of our faith. May they stay with us until we meet again.
Tell me.